this country is at war with Germany. With Germany.
We shall go on to the end.
I remember the sheets of flame which came up and almost blinded us from our guns.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. During the war, the whole of Britain's coastline was involved in the struggle against the Nazis. In 1940-41, invasion was the main threat. Many towns and cities around the coast, such as Plymouth, Portsmouth, Hull and Great Yarmouth, were all targets of devastating air raids throughout the war. The East Coast was pivotal to North Sea operations against enemy mining and E-boat operations, and the western ports, particularly Liverpool, were crucial to the vital Atlantic convoys and the defeat of the U-boat threat. In this episode, I'm joined once more by cultural and social historian Neil Storey to discuss Britain's Coast at War, which is also the title of his book, Britain's Coast at War, Invasion Threat, Coastal Forces, Bombardment and Training for D-Day. Now, before we get there, this podcast is brought to you by the kind contributions of fellow listeners. If you think there is a vast machine at work in the background with assistants, researchers, audio engineers, all beavering away, paid for by a philanthropic millionaire, you'll be wrong. It's just me. But I could use your help. All this costs me, and it's not just my time. Software and research material prove to be an ongoing cost. Now, if each one of you tossed a shekel in my virtual tip jar at patreon.com/ww2podcast, I would have a pretty good monthly salary, but I appreciate not everyone has the luxury of spare change. But if you do enjoy the show every couple of weeks, why not go to patreon.com/ww2podcast and become a patron of the show. Now, Neil, welcome back. I thought we would actually start with the First World War rather than the Second World War. In building up to World War One, we have a whole host of invasion scares. Then in 1914, we have the bombing of the northeast coast and plans are drawn up in case of German invasion. Now, what I wondered was, did these plans get regularly updated in the interwar years, or was coastal and civil defence not seen as a priority and spending ratcheted back?
Whenever there is war, of course, the budget will be there to build ditches, emplacements, fortifications. Out of wartime, it's often the budget gets slashed. And you can see that goes right back in history. Clear examples from Tudor Britain, 1588, the time of the Spanish Armada. There are fortifications and planned fortifications all around our coastline, beautiful star forts that they plan to have. But again, you'll see it during the Napoleonic Wars, World War One, with the advent of the pillbox. And people may not realize that the original pillboxes were round. And some of the very first were built along the North Norfolk coast and the inland waterways. And they are circular. And because in those days, if you bought pills from Boots or wherever, they'd come in a little round pill box. So no matter what shape they may be after that, they all began as circular defences. By 1918, they're looking more at a more developed shape, how are the blast walls, how are they going to work? Construction became more considered. And they were building pill boxes in Britain up until 1918. Because believe it or not, now we talk about the invasion scares, certainly the big scares of 1914, early 1915, when we get the first Zeppelin raids over Great Britain. But we mustn't forget Britain on a number of occasions between 1914 and 1918 was shelled from our coastline. So these are Imperial German Navy scouting flotillas. They're parking off the coastline. So the first one's November 1914 off Great Yarmouth and Galston. Then you get December 1914 when we get the first casualties. That was off Scarborough and Hartlepool and Whitby, believe it or not. And they got a shelling. And poor old Hartlepool, you know, you got terrible numbers of casualties caused there. So the thinking was for the military, you've got to be seen to be doing something. So they built fortifications along the coast, sometimes using old Napoleonic fortification positions to put naval guns in and to fire back. And also, if the German Navy did try and land troops here, that's why they kept on building those pillboxes.
What I find interesting about that is, because in my ignorance, you see the pillboxes along the coast and you automatically just think the Second World War. And they're not. That I can't tell the difference between one or the other. And it is on my hit list of things to do, actually, what we're on with a to try and figure out which is which. But you kind of just got the first one. And actually, no, there is a much longer history to this coastal defence.
And in fact, if you look at the positions for the coastal defences, some of them, there have been fortifications in that area, sometimes on that spot, since the Romans. Because you can see that there were chains of beacons. And let's face it, if you've got natural harbours, so there's an old saying, he who old England would hope to win must at Weybourne hope begin. It's a natural harbour. You're not going to change that. So it will always be a place that they will fear that the enemy might make a landing, be it the Spanish Armada, Napoleon, the Kaiser, or Adolf Hitler.
And your classic example of that has to be Dover Castle, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And it's one of the gateways to England, probably the greatest of all of our gateways. You know, but that fine bastion, you see, we have to remember, you're saying about they've always been scarce. We mustn't forget, you know, we are an island society. So if you are an island, although we've got a fantastic moat, there will always be a concern that some enemy might want to try and cross them and invade. And when we get to World War II, there were still the invasion scares, but also the real concerns about raiding parties coming in.
So when did they start building up this idea of some form of civil defence? I presume it's in the late 30s then, tried putting on some sort of official footing.
Well, what happened was, after the First World War, to just put it into a little bit of context, there was a great feeling for no more war. So they put in Great Britain, created this 10-year rule where the funding would be slashed. They had what they called the Geddes Acts. And the Army, Navy, Air Force, intelligence services were all not only stopped for recruiting and downsized, but cut back in peacetime. When we get to 1930, there's actually concerns of what's going on in the Far East. And there's large armies mobilizing out there, and that causes a bit of a rumbling. So people start thinking about protection. In fact, from the mid-1920s, the concern over aerial attack, you know, we'd had not only Zeppelins, but we'd had what they called the Gotha Bombers, the latter years of World War I. Zeppelins came by night. Gotha bombers came by daytime. So they said, we're going to start Observer Corps again. Originally, that was taken out of the special constabulary. You had to be a special constable to be part of the Observer Corps. And the fears over aerial warfare, the predictions that were coming out from the experts were, you know, this is going to be serious. Cities could burn. And then when you get to the mid-1930s, you get the Spanish Civil War. And the bombing of Guernica, that shocked the world. So the idea of ARP had been discussed. The Ramsay-MacDonald government in the mid-1930s in Britain had put the idea out there. They'd formed a department for air raid precautions. But nothing was really done until after the bombing of Guernica. That frightened a lot of people. And there were predictions made that if you had this number of bombers, this number of firebombs, that it would be possible to have huge knockout blows dealt to major cities. And it wasn't long after that they started saying, well, yes, London could be annihilated in a week. And the predictions for the amount of explosives that would be dropped in that week were far in excess of the entire bombing of London in the Second World War. But it got people concerned. And so the ARP Act is passed. Local governments not only have to have committees and paper provisions, they've got to start identifying places that can be converted into shelters. So it could be old underground passageways, unused areas of the tube system in London, for example. But in other cities around the place, there are often old underground roads or workings. Down in Dover, for example, you know, there were tunnels that were not being used by the military anymore. And so they're putting in bunk beds and they're preparing. So it's really from the mid-30s we start seeing the civil defence, or what was known in those days as the Air Raid Precautions Organisation. By late 39, 40, they were known as civil defence.
Which government ministry is that under? Is that under the War Office? Is there a is that devolved completely to the regions, left to the Lord? I mean, during the First World War, a lot of it's left to the Lord Lieutenants.
Well, it cascades down. So really you're talking about a ministry, the equivalent Ministry of Home Security. And you've got your main man there, which is John Anderson. Of course, the man that gave his name to the Anderson Shelter. So you've got your top echelon. Then if it's civil, it cascades down really from your regional commissioners. Now, regional commissioners are quite interesting because they're described as regional commissioners for civil defence. And these were regions. So, for example, Norfolk, Suffolk, Cambridgeshire, and other counties in that immediate area, that becomes quite a serious region, doesn't it? You've got London region, other parts of the country are divided up, each with a regional commissioner. And yes, he is responsible to make, ultimately, he and his team have, and they've got big underground bunkers, they've got a control centre. They will be saying, right, let's make sure that every town has got its air raid precautions in place. We need to make sure that every village, and so that would be under the Rural District Council. So it kind of cascades. But it was also down to the regional commissioners that if martial law has to be enacted, it goes through him. If the serious stuff, for example, when I was looking at spies and collaborators, the lists of collaborators go through a panel. All the chief constables would gather. There would be the RSLO, which is the Regional Security Liaison Officer, which is really the MI5 field officer for that area. And they would discuss these cases. Each case would be brought up with the evidence presented, should they be on the list or not. And so if the balloon does go up, the man that has to take over in the event of martial law is the regional commissioner. On a separate note, the Lord Lieutenant, in effect, the representative of the king, when it came to things like organizing the local defense volunteers, then it was the gift of the Lord Lieutenant, who would know the people in local power, you know, the well-known landowners, all this kind of stuff. He would know. So they would be the zone commanders, and they used the old police zones across the county. And then it would be built from that.
So the bomber always gets through. We've got panic. We've got air, we've not got panic. We've got the air. We've got people worrying about the air raid precautions. Now, in London, you know, you have evacuations, war breaks out, and people are being evacuated. We're looking at the coast. Was the coast expected to have be hit as a major target? Are people being evacuated from the coast? Is the coastal areas thinned out for, well, for protection of life, or is it thinned out for other reasons?
Yeah, well, there's different things that happen in different stages during the war. When they start the evacuation scheme that was really laid out in 1938, you see, 1938, during there was the Munich crisis. Now, people often forget that we were on the brink of war. You know, the key men of the Territorial Army were in their drill halls. If this goes wrong, we're going to be at a state of war. And we'd had a similar situation even into the mid-1930s when you've got the problem with the Saar region. And it's one of these divided countries which borders, you know, the sort of German, Belgium, France. They've all got an interest in it. Britain's got an interest in the Saar. And they go to the people and they say, well, look, we got to a stage now. You've got to decide who runs the Saar region. So they held a vote, and to make sure the vote was enforced, they sent out a contingent of a number of regular army units from the British Army. The vote comes in for the Tsar, and guess what? The people there think, hey, we're going to give this Hitler guy a go. Yeah, yeah, that's a really good idea. He gets the country moving. So they vote to go with Hitler. But when we get to 38, and the parallels with the modern world, it's absolutely chilling for if you know your history. And, you know, Hitler, he's looking to annex the Sudetenland. He's been given chunks of land. That was the deal they reached at Munich. But if it had gone wrong, not only would the territorial army have been mobilized, but there would have been evacuation. So it was all it was a very well-oiled machine. Where do you evacuate from? Well, not just London. You evacuate from anywhere where there is a concentration of factories that could be construed as war production factories. For example, your classics around your Birmingham, your Manchester. They're all areas you evacuate from. Evacuation wasn't compulsory, but it was thought, this is a good idea, get out. In areas where it might be dangerous, it's not, places like Norwich, they're given a neutral rating. So there's children neither evacuated there nor evacuated from. Although, you know, parents could always think, oh, I want my kids in a more rural area, so they'll just pack them off to auntie whatnot or a family friend in the country. But when they did take the children out of, you know, industrial areas everywhere from Newcastle on Tyne, right through the Midlands, all across the country, they evacuated them to rural areas and to the coastline.
It has me thinking they were taking them from the coast because of the threat of invasion or postal ports. Or
you have to remember, in 1939, it's a period where in the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force, no way was it a phony war. But on land, and, you know, in the American press, they're looking at the British Army that's in line, you know, it's near the Maginot Line. It's occupying part of the Maginot Line with the French, you know, rotating there. If you get too close to the Belgian frontier, they'll fire at you, as they would do if the Germans got too close. In certain areas, there was quite a tacit understanding that you do not shoot at the Germans if you happen to see them. And there was sort of waving across tracts of land where they're quite close to each other. So it was a time when there was no notion of there being an invasion, to be absolutely honest. 1939 to May 1940, it's described in the press as a phony war, as I say, at sea and in the air. Far, far from it. It's a vicious war where merchant vessels and civilian passengers are going down. It's a horrible, horrible war. But you see, the First World War had been a war which was fought from trench to trench. You think of the Western Front. And for many, although there was mechanization, yes, there's modern aircraft, there are fears over air raids. But at that time, German raiders are dropping mines at sea. That's what you're getting. There's no immediate threat. And there was a certain confidence that France will never fall. You know, we've got an incredible Maginot Line. It didn't fall in World War I. Why should it fall now? And what possible danger could any sort of German threat be as long as we've got a Royal Navy to patrol the Channel? And they felt very confident that we'd mined the Channel effectively with a few lanes to get our supply ships through. But we felt very, very safe. And if there was going to be an invasion, the thinking was, well, the chances are it will come from Holland. It will come across the North Sea rather than the Channel, because the Dutch ports could cope with that. And certainly right up until May, when there was invasion of the Low Countries, Belgium, the thought was, they're going to come across the North Sea because the ports are our deal for that. The Channel, that was thought was pretty impregnable. Even up to, you know, the fall of France, really.
Well, we get to the fall of France, that Dunkirk. You think of the French side of the operation, not necessarily the British side of the operation, and you think of the little boats. And that got me thinking, well, where do you get little boats? Are these little boats all from, surely they can't all be from Dover? What, you know, where are all the little boats that are involved in Operation Dynamo? How far along the course are these communities getting involved with that evacuation operation.
They're coming down from the north of England. I mean, right up Berwick-on-Tweed. They had minesweepers from North Shields in Northumberland. And the men that were due to be on leave called back. No, down you go. And then it's you've got Margate, you've got Ramsgate that often gets forgotten. But yeah, you've also got Dover. You've got the vessels on the Thames. They are seaworthy, but making that journey across is tricky. So they would often get a larger vessel to tow the smaller vessels over there. It was Dynamo was the most incredible effort. It was truly. But then you've got beyond Dynamo, as we've got before that, you've got people getting them out from Boulogne. But then you've got Operation Cycle and Operation Ariel, and they've got people going right down to Saint-Nazaire. It was only the last evacuation of St. Valery where our vessels really couldn't get in, and you lose the majority of the 51st Highland Division. Terrible, terrible St. Valery. Terrible loss. But overall, the evacuation of France in British and French troops, you know, and Belgian troops from France, it was an incredible achievement. But as Churchill said, you know, you don't win wars with evacuations.
So when they're bringing them back, though, do they all go through Dover, or is the whole of those eastern ports being utilised, at which point all those people in those coastal areas are seeing firsthand what's happened in France as it arrives back?
What you're getting, you've got Dover and Ramsgate. Ramsgate often gets forgotten, and there are other ports where they're receiving. And it was quite contained, that you'd get off the boat, they'd pile your arms, and then you get loaded onto trains. And it was the train loads that people saw, and the efforts on some of the tiny, tiny little stations where people worked around the clock, knowing that there'd be a train from Dunkirk that will come up and it will stop at that station for a very, very limited period of time. They didn't have a huge supply of paper cups. Luckily, there was a canning factory nearby. So the lit cans without the lids on them were given to soldiers. So if you look at some of the photos, if they go through, I think it was Headcorn, and there was another station nearby there as well, you'll see the lads with tin cans in their hands. And that's so that they could drink and maybe throw it out the window so that they could, the local folks could go and collect them. There was also a scheme by you'd be given a postcard and you could write on it and you could throw it out. And these would be collected to let your family and posted to let your family know that you're okay.
And that's because they're not allowed out of the train, are they?
That's right.
Trying to keep the tempo up.
Absolutely right. Yeah, so you'll see these wonderful images of ladies from all sorts of local organisations, those on leave, those from local units, men and women, Army, Navy, Air Force, everybody that could possibly be spared. And the quantities are absolutely incredible, making jam sandwiches and wads through the night, and then going along with baker's trays, pies after pies after pies. Incredibly powerful time. People say, typically British, stiff upper lip. Well, what are you going to do? You do the best you can, whether you're civilian or Army, Navy or Air Force. You help your comrades, help your folks, you know?
It's funny because all the images, so many images of those lads arriving back are all with them in the train. And I hadn't quite appreciated it. It's because the words allowed out of the train, because if they wandered off, you have to get them on and it might slow the trains down. So just lock the doors. That's why all the pictures of them being handed things in the train.
That's right. I mean, I think sometimes they did have a little scamper if you needed a wee. And sometimes if they were on the trains of wounded that were coming back. So you'll see more of the lads with the sort of slings on, or when they're waiting at places like Ramsgate, Margate, there's more gathered on the station, and you'll see those photos. But yeah, when they're going through places like Headcorn or on the way to London, they're through the windows, bless them.
So the fall of France, if we thought we were secure, all those Channel ports, you know, that must have been a shock. And how much does that change the life in these coastal areas? Does it suddenly become a militarized zone? You know, we've discussed pillboxes, but does that go into overdrive building? I mean, it's funny because we talk about pillboxes, then you talk in France, you talk about the Atlantic Wall, these big Teutonic helmets, but we never seem to have quite got to that level of defence.
Oh, no, we're not doing that sort of faff around, you know, for God's sake. The minute you've got the fall of France around about that time, you've got to get somebody in to do the job. You'd had old Walter Kirk, and he'd had planned Julius Caesar, which was the defence of Britain in the event of invasion. But you've got to now think, well, we're going to have to bring in a new broom, somebody that the public will recognise, somebody who's dynamic and impressive in the public eye. This is what you need, public confidence at this time. Now, that's crucial. Churchill knows this. So who do we get? Well, Tiny Ironside, General and very soon Field Marshal Ironside. And he gets a lot of criticism, sometimes quite justly. But at that, we have to think about history at that time. The guy is recognised as a distinguished senior British military officer, one of the youngest brigade commanders of the First World War, a good, solid military career. He looks impressive, and you would feel, yeah, this guy can do something. Now, he's a man of his time. He's an ex-Scotland rugby international. He was a public school educated man, but a man that had a lifetime in the army. Now, if you have a smashed British Expeditionary Force, you've got a lot of men in training still, because we've had conscription since 1939. In his experience, what else is he going to do? And what do the public want to see to be done? Is that we're going to build our defences. And Ironside thought, well, if you dig trenches in, if we get entrenched, we can put these guys in, they can fire a rifle. He was confident that the British soldier, and we had allies, the guys coming over from Canada, we had Empire troops as well, as an, you know. So we mustn't forget that he was confident the British and Allied troops in Britain would stand firm. He was absolutely convinced of that. So he creates the Ironside crust, the coastal crust, and he also begins these what they call the stop lines. So this idea is, if you think about it in principle, what else can you do? And he does it quite well, and he's got to work very, very quickly. So he gets Admiral Frederick Dreyer, and he conducts a coastal survey, and he actually begins in East Anglia. Because remember, the thought is if they're going to come, they're going to come across the North Sea. They're still fairly confident that the channel would hold. So he surveys from East Anglia and then just above, going up towards Lincolnshire. In the end, he will go all the way up to Berwick-on-Tweed. He kind of also sees that now with the fall of France and looking at the aircraft that are coming over and the reports that they're getting quite rapidly that Hitler's massing troops in Boulogne, you know, there's sea-going barges. Something's going on there. They're being collected there for a reason. So he surveys all of that coastline. And it's quite clever. They work out what are the beaches that are most vulnerable, the beaches that are going to support armoured fighting vehicles and tanks landing without the Germans needing to put some method of roadway down there. Remember, the funnies haven't been developed yet, so you've got to have something firm enough to sustain that landing until they can get a pontoon established. We knew if the Germans were going to land, they would land by rubber boat. But when they want to start getting the heavy stuff, we thought, well, they're going to go for ports and they're going to go for hard beaches. So we need to survey all that. Think about things like coastal batteries. And Dreyer was the man that said, look, yeah, we've got guns out to sea, but we've got no canopies over them. That's common sense. But, you know, you've got enemy aircraft coming over. They can look down. They can see the coastal battery and drop a bomb straight on it. So you need to put, you know, bomb-proof shelters over those batteries. So that's pretty good. It's Dreyer that's also going around saying, look, we've got piers that are sticking out to sea. We're going to need to either take a section out of that or blow it up. You know, it's as simple as that. And the priority has to be on the East Coast, South Coast. You know, that's the way we have to do it. Lovely story about it in Cromer. Dreyer went there and he said, you've still got an intact pier. Oh, they said, oh dear. So the local engineers unit say, right, well, let's blow it up. Let's get a hole blown in the section. Great. Bang. Off it goes. And a large metal pole ends up embedding itself in Cromer Marketplace. But the problem was, that was pointed out soon after, is that, well, our lifeboat house is at the end of the pier, so we can't get across. So they had to put a little single man at a time walkway across to get to the other side of the pier for the lifeboat crews. So, yeah, it does have a sort of Dad's Army ring to it. But what Ironside also thought, well, if we're looking at the defences, we need to think, how can we stop these landings in these most crucial areas? So you're putting in, initially, it's what they call the Dannett concertina wire and the coils of barbed wire. There are, and here's something that often gets forgotten, thousands upon thousands of mines that are being laid on vulnerable beaches. And then it's every few miles, at the very most, I think it's every mile, you've got a pillbox. You know, and sometimes, you know, you'll have a pillbox and a fortification as well. We forget there are fortifications being built, quite serious ones, what they call coastal forts, literally, as well as coastal batteries. So it's a serious network all around the coast. And then we end up with these stop lines, which really, they divide down Middle England from up Berwick-on-Tweed. There are stop lines in Scotland, and that's under Scottish command, but the main one in England comes down really from Edinburgh. It skirts down slightly to the right of Middle England, so all of the industrial areas are behind that. And then it goes around Cambridge in East Anglia, and then it goes down bottom of the Medway. It skirts round to the right of London, if you look down on England, and it goes right along the south coast, which is great. And unless you're in certain fighter groups, and the fighter command was saying, yeah, we're really chuffed with that, because if they land, by the time they get to the stop line, they will have already taken out the majority of fighter airfields. So you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. I think the main problem with poor old Tiny Ironside was that one of his main advisors was Boney Fuller. Now, Major General Fuller was a man who, he'd seen the advantage of increasingly armoured warfare in a modern battlefield context. The Germans had really impressed him. And when you read into the darker history of 1940, Fuller was part of the Black Shirt organisation. And there was one particular coup that was set up in the London area. Fuller was up the top, if not the leader of it. The idea was that these would be a fifth column, would rise up and hand London over to the invasion forces in exchange that they were expecting to be put in charge. They would be the Gamma Knighters. Churchill certainly got wind of that, and no more Fuller's pushed out. And because he's an advisor and considered a trusted friend of Ironside, who may or may not have been a black shirt or a sympathizer, we can't damn the man with that, because there's no proof, but there were close connections. And Alan Brooke, he's down on the south coast, and along with Montgomery, who at that time was a three-div commander, they had Churchill's ear, and certainly Alan Brooke discussed a way forward that would involve more mobile troops. Because that was the big criticism. Churchill really didn't like to see all these pillboxes and defences being built, and all that time expended by experience, by soldiers that should be gaining experience in fighting, not just building the defences. So Ironside had to go, and Alan Brooke took his place.
Alan Brooke comes in. How much? I mean, Alan Brooke's thinking about defence in depth and mobile forces, but and that perhaps leads into, I was going to ask about, we mentioned it earlier, Went the Deer Well, this threat of, Went the Deer Well's the propaganda film about German parachuters dropping in. How much was that perceived to be a threat in those early years of the war? Was there anything that they did, because presumably to combat that, because presumably the logical place to drop would be over those coastal areas and perhaps Caesar Port or somewhere friendly where you could bring in forces by the sea?
It's interesting, you know. Erhard Milch, I guess you could call him Goering's deputy in the Luftwaffe, but really he was the clever money. And he said, well, why don't we know where the airfields are. Why don't we, rather than keep bombing the airfields, you know, with this idea, he said, why don't we get planes full of crack troops or paratroops, drop them on airfields and get them to take them out? Chilling, isn't it? What could have happened? I don't think they had the number of paratroopers to really make that happen. But if the focus had changed, it's one of those if moments, isn't it? Paratroopers from May 1940, they'd seen the invasion of Belgium, Holland, Low Countries. Paratroopers are involved. And there were certainly stories of paratroopers being dressed in everything from nuns to police officers. And there was a wonderful Heath Robinson illustration of just that. But it's real in that paratroopers could come. They were quite frightening because they were seen as quite an elite troop. So what are you going to do? And that's why in May 1940, within days of the Blitzkrieg being unleashed on Belgium and France, there's an appeal made to the British people by Anthony Eden. And he asks for a new organization known as the Local Defense Volunteers. Men who were too young or too old or in war reserved occupations to come forward and do their bit for king and country. These early units were often known as parashots. And the idea was that they would look, they'd be observers. They weren't really seen as a combat unit. The idea was they would look, they'd patrol around areas looking for enemy, you know, invasion or parachutists. And if they saw them, the idea was that they would report it to the local military, and then they would have a mobile unit that would come and respond to that. It was only when Churchill really took the reins of the LDV and had a chance to focus on them that they became better armed and equipped, and their name was retitled to the Home Guard. But in those early days of LDV, when it's kind of reporting in, the armband LDV didn't just stand for Local Defense Volunteers. It also stood for Look, Duck, and Vanish. But what is interesting, when you see these early days of invasion threat, are that the hodgepodge defenses that places were putting up. You know, yeah, you've got your pillboxes and you've got a coastal crust, but you hear, seen the poster, is your journey really necessary? Well, they're closing down coastal areas. But what are they making as roadblocks? Well, yes, you'll see this, what they call the knife rest, 2X shape, good shaped logs with a rest across the middle, often with a spiral of barbed wire across it that could be moved from side to side. And there were anti-tank blocks, and they were putting in these rails and dragon's teeth. But there were also some real hotchpotchy stuff down in Brighton. They took some of the wooden seaside beach houses, and they filled them with shingle to block the road. It looks like Invasion of the Beach Huts. Seriously, there's photographs in the book. In Great Yarmouth, they've got loads of herring barrels, so they're filling those up with stones as well to block roads. And this was another thing that Churchill soon picked up on, that, and other commanders did, that, yeah, well, right, you've blocked that bit of road, but there's nothing to stop the German tank just pulling to the side, knocking through one of the old cottages or the verge, or just going over it, just go round the darn things. So a lot of this was a kind of cosmetic effort, even down to probably the later innovation of what they call the Admiralty scaffolding. That was also pretty good stuff. It came in a bit late in the day, but they're the ones that you see all along the beaches to stop landing craft coming in, and they'd put mines on that as well. But I've got a horrible feeling that the devices attached to them and exercises carried out on that scaffolding, and indeed the minefields, killed more British service personnel and civilians than any enemy.
Well, I mean, it's part of the messaging, though, I guess, isn't it? If you're trying to keep morale up, they're going to be the first line of defence of the coast. Doing anything gives the impression of security than just having nothing, even if it's just a beach house full of shingle.
Absolutely right. Yeah, it's a lot of it is about morale. When you're facing potentially a tidal wave of enemies suddenly hitting you, you don't really know where they're going to come. You've got a good idea, but you never, ever know. Land, sea, air, you know, they've got to cross a channel. So that, you know, they're not going to be able to march straight in. So it's sea, it's air. What's going to happen? Parachutists? Is it going to be boats? Who knows?
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. I'm talking to Neil Storey about Britain's coast at war. You know, these little coastal ports, which you know, presumably the sea is their lifeline. What happens to them, Jonah? What do the fishermen still fish? Do we have a shortage? Our small merchant ship going up and down the coast like they always did? Or does that all grind to a halt along the east coast? I presume it's probably fine on the west coast.
Nowhere is fine. The western approaches, the Irish Sea, that's patrolled by U-boats just like anywhere else. It's absolutely deadly. Make no mistake, western approaches, yes, it's a key link to get us out to the Atlantic, and Germany knew that too. So there is no easy route into Great Britain. In Scotland even, of course, you've got to remember that's getting closer to the Norwegian captured countries of Scandinavia. So there's a fear that there could be invasion from that there as well. So nowhere is safe. The merchant trade is slashed. It's absolutely slashed. We are still getting supply ships through, but my goodness, the merchantman's war is often forgotten.
But do they concentrate them on the big ports? But all those little ports that would have moved stuff just internal trades?
What you tended to have, the smaller ports, they've got booms across the harbours because they don't want these hit-and-run MTBs coming in there. So they become quite heavily defended. You've got larger ports or satellites of the larger ports that are now becoming more active. So the classic port that would be on the map, X marks the spot, they're trying to use other ones nearby, if you see what I mean. But you think about Merseyside. I mean, that's what they're aiming for. There's a blitz on Merseyside. Think of London and the Thames. After 1940 and the Nazi campaign against Great Britain, they didn't win the Battle of Britain. There's a great thought, and it's often forgotten, that the invasion threat was revived again in spring 1941. That's often forgotten. You know, we might have had a success in the air, but that's still coming. It should not be, that really shouldn't be forgotten. And when we look at 1941-42, yes, you haven't got a big blitz on London anymore, but now they are concentrating on the factory towns. They're concentrating on ports in 41. I mean, when we get to 1942, that's when you've got the Baedeker Blitz. The plan is to attack the historic cities of Great Britain in an attempt to break morale. So nowhere is safe. So, yeah, the merchant vessels, it's tough. It really is tough. British war production, that's why you bring in things like the Women's Land Army, allotment programs, every patch of land possibly that could go into production for food and war production. That's patriotic. It's right. And you can get fined quite seriously if you're not utilizing your land correctly. So it's a huge effort. Fishermen, yes, they do carry on. They leave a fisherman's gap in most of these. If there's a fishing community, there's a small gap left on the beach that they can operate from there. And that's a great staple for folks. But once we get to that, the fall of France, you've got this threat. And the first thing that Ironside did was withdraw all the children, people who are infirm, pregnant mothers, people with disabilities. They are withdrawn from the coast. So that's Evac 2. And a lot of them do go over to the west. They go to other parts of the country. Anywhere rather than the south and east coast. You know, it's a huge operation, but it's often forgotten that kids hate being away from home, quite rightly. And if there's not a lot of air raids going on there, they'll go back a lot. But then if it starts to heat up that there's air raids on the city nearby you, then the kids get sent away again. And you'll see tragic pictures of these families that get bombed out from around the country. That with children, you know, and then they have to come to other places around the country to find a new home having been bombed out. It wasn't just London, and it was a phenomena we saw. The last people, you know, sort of bombed out, were coming to some places as late as 1944.
My mother-in-law was evacuated for whatever her duration of the war was from Southampton. She went to somewhere in Norfolk, which obviously Southampton's quite heavily bombed.
Any docks, you see? Any docks can be a target. And to be honest with you, it didn't take a great deal of savvy. The Germans built up this they had a military geographisch unit in Berlin from the 1930s, and they were collecting maps. Let's face it, Ordnance Survey was not exclusive. Anybody could order a set of UK Ordnance Survey maps in the 1930s. That's simple. 1930s was a great age for aerial photography. So they collected the catalogues, the guidebooks. Oh, here's our factory from the air. Look at that. Oh, yes. And the German businessmen were asked to collect these and, you know, give it to your local party organiser. And they went to the military geographic unit. They even had both these Bundesdeutsches Maidens, BDM girls on bicycles, Hitler Youth boys. And part of their special badges was to go on a cycle ride, a long one, to foreign countries, and that included Great Britain. And that really did stir MI5 up when, you know, you got the local Rotary clubs and youth hostel organisations saying, oh, yes, come and have a look at our lovely factories that we're building here. Take lots of photographs. Here's some leaflets. Nice aerial photographs in the leaflets. You know, take it home. You know, what can you do?
So does parts of Britain's coastline just become belts of anti-aircraft guns as well to try and prevent the bomber as it came across?
Yeah, parts of the south coast, and particularly when you get towards the latter part of the war when you've got V-weapons coming along, they're absolutely stacking up along the south to stop this weaponry coming into Britain. And so you look at places like St. Leonard's, you go around the Brighton area as well, South Sea, Portsmouth. You just see it about Hastings, because let's face it, you know, it's an ideal invasion place. We learned that back in 1066. All around that Hastings coastline, yeah. I mean, there are restricted areas. There are areas that, when we start getting to late 43 into 44, people are told you've got to leave your coastal village. Now, the promise for some of them was that you would come back, but for some of them, no, that village community is no more and is still no more. They're firing ranges for the MOD, and they needed these bays along the south coast to help train troops for the D-Day landings.
Tynham's the classic little village, isn't it, that gets evacuated?
Yes, Tynham. But there were other villages around. You see, that's the main one, but there were little hamlets around Tynham that get forgotten. There's part of the Downs that was taken over as well.
Because the first time I went to Tynham 30 years ago, there was just a military policeman stood there. Nobody really visited. And we went back last year or the year before. I was quite surprised. There's a 50-car car park. It's very well organised. It's not just ruins in trees anymore. It's all been cleared back, and you can actually get a sense of a village and some sort of village life to explain the story.
But you still can't go every time, because they, you know, if it's being used, if the firing range nearby is being used, they ain't having you there.
Well, then you've got that thing, you walk to the bay, and on either side there's burnt out wrecks of things that they've been firing at for the last 30 years on the range.
It's charming little bay full of, you know, fishermen's cottages nearby. But, you know, you've got Slapton Sands, which is the classic case, where it was people were told, given very little notice, really. But luckily, they did come back after the war. But Slapton, that was a dreadful thing. That during the training, some of these very rapid German motorboats got amongst one of the training exercises, and quite a lot of men were killed in that, badly injured because the things were amongst them. Shocking. And that was hushed up for a very long while. And when you go to further along the coast, you go to Woolacombe, super training base there. And I think amongst the dunes around there, I haven't been down myself yet, but I believe from folks that have told me that they've got concrete kind of landing craft that you could practice your evacuations from around there. And in fact, along in those areas, they actually in the UK built a section of the Atlantic Wall so we could practice assaulting it.
Now, wherever seen that, South Downs somewhere, there's something like that.
I think so, yeah, yeah. But for the key for D-Day, though, you've had the training up in Scotland. And that, they were the key troops, the commandos. Go around the Inveraria way, up to Speen Bridge as well, where they've got the Commando Memorial now, beautiful thing. But really, if you think of Loch Fyne, you might have heard of Loch Fyne restaurants. Loch Fyne, it's a huge loch, and there were various training bases, Army, Navy, Air Force, specialist units. Even the US Rangers trained up that way. And that was the key to D-Day. And then once we get to really 1944, in the early months, they start shunting the troops around a little bit. And as they prepare for D-Day, that's Operation Fabius. Sorry, Exercise Fabius. And there's a number of stages to Fabius, but the troops are practicing their landings. So in many ways, the British countryside and the coast, although had to be defended, it had to be protected, also helped train our boys to go back and girls to do their bit too. And we mustn't forget, you know, there's nurses, there are auxiliary troops from troops from all nations that use that coast to train to make the D-Day landings so successful.
I went to university in Southampton and I remember drinking in a pub there and they had pictures of the war on the wall of the common. And you suddenly think, well, all these ports along the south coast are taking men for overlord. The whole area must have been absolutely chocker with servicemen, absolutely everywhere who can't speak. And it must have been such a surreal experience being a local to be suddenly surrounded by men and material just waiting to go.
That was really on the eve of the departure. Before that, they were moved to bases near the coast and they were locked in. You weren't allowed to go into towns and places. They had to deceive Hitler. And that's what was known as Operation Fortitude. And Operation Fortitude saw places like Breydon Water in Great Yarmouth have false barges. Our supposed barges for invasion troops are actually glorified film props, and parts of Kent had the guys from Pinewood and special camouflage departments, Colonel Turner's department, he was attached to the Royal Air Force, a whole lot of subterfuge, you know, using people with film and theatre skills to make it and look like there are troop movements. Camps are built to look like active military camps. It's all a sham. And there's even a huge amount of radio traffic created as well. It was a huge, huge effort, but it worked. A lot of the camps where we had the troops that were actually going over, they were in forests, these holding camps where they were. And they'd do some training, but then they'd do these beach exercises with Fabius. Exercise Fabius. It was only really day or so before Operation Overlord was launched that they were down in the south coast, and really that was just into the towns. And there was these huge trail backs of tanks, armored fighting vehicles, all sorts along those roads. It was incredible, but it wasn't the massive extended period of interaction. Although, that said, the number of old boys that said, I met my girl just before I left, you know, and they came back. They were lucky enough to come back. They did find them, these lovely girls, and they stayed in touch, you know.
We've talked about pillboxes, mining beaches, scaffolds to prevent parachutist landing, trenches. You know, it is sort of there and it's sort of all isn't there. How long does it, I mean, specifically mining with mine beaches, how long does it take them to clear these beaches? Because you can kind of think, people think, well, the war's won, we won't worry too much about it, we'll do what we have to do, and it sort of just, you know, gets left to one side.
You're absolutely right. By the way, the Admiralty scaffolding didn't stop the paratroopers, but it did stop the landing craft. you can't do an awful lot to stop parachutists, unless you can kind of get a machine gun on a ground mount and start to spray the air or point your rifles up. But clearing it all away, it took decades. The ironwork from beaches, when I was a kid, I can remember seeing the joints from scaffolding on the beaches down in Kent when I went to see my Uncle Ernie. He was on coastal defences, you know, when I was a lad in the 1970s, 1980s. And I said, well, Uncle Ernie, what's this? All that scaffolding, boy, you just have to put that up on the beach, you know. But they were bits that lingered. The ironwork, you can always sell iron as scrap. Plenty of that after World War II going around. But to clear the beaches, well, the Royal Engineers are very good, that they mapped where all the mines were laid. Trouble is, coastal erosion doesn't help that. So when you go back to try and find them, you've had cliffs collapse and tidal drift and all sorts of stuff. And it was into the 1970s, and it was what they called the Munsley Minefield near Trimmingham on the North Norfolk coast. That was one of the last to be absolutely said, like, this is completely clear. And the trouble was, over the years, that they would announce a beach somewhere, oh, it's cleared, we're safe now, but then they'd suddenly find another batch of the stuff. So it's always difficult to say what is the last beach to be cleared. And to be honest with you, if you get a scour, you can still see beach defences under many well-known beaches up in Northumberland. There's a beach near Blyth had a scour, and it looked like a scene from Private Ryan. It's there, that all the ironwork, incredible. So the echoes are still there. And I'm not going to put people off going to the beach, don't. But occasionally, yeah, a bomb, a mine, a sea mine, they're still being uncovered. Old ordnance, because the trouble was, they thought, oh, yeah, we'll bury the ordnance in the bottom of the field that was on the top of the cliff. And then years later, it tumbles all down. It's all over the beach.
It's incredible, because it never fails to amaze me when you look with different eyes what is still visible. And that is almost the invisible is what you could see, because it's the more overt stuff that's all gone. It's the barbed wire and those kind of things.
And also, when you have a look around, look at historic buildings that are by the coast as well. So it could be an old monastery. I know Brumholme Priory in Backton in Norfolk. They've still got the rifle loops, and one of the corners of the building, it's an embrasure for heavy machine guns. So look and look again, because not all of those features that you see on the historic buildings are medieval. They might just be World War II defences.
Indeed, Neil. I'll never look at a building on the coastline again without looking for loopholes. Well, Neil, let's leave it there. Thank you. Loyal listener, if you want to know more, Neil's book is Britain's Coast at War, Invasion Threat, Coastal Forces, Bombardment and Training for D-Day. I'll put a link in the show notes and on the website www.podcast.com. In the next episode, I'm joined by Mark Urban, who has written an authorised history of the British Parachute Regiment during the war. So until then, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
Jerry 88mm gun hit our tank, blew us the hell out of it.
Stalingrad can never be repaired.
As Allied Commander-in-Chief, I have granted a military armistice.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.